Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Carlotta Ribello. Coming up today, we honour the life of the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and then discuss the life and works of one of Britain's most prolific playwrights. Also ahead.
He came up with a phrase that love cannot express the idea of music while music may give an idea of love.
Poison and Scandal. We hear the love stories behind some of the most well-known classical compositions. And
here's the thing. I cook barbecue whilst I spin tunes. I cook beats and meats. And I always think DJs look really boring, so I wear custom-made outfits by Rita Ora and Jesse J's designer.
DJ barbecue on spandex, grilling, and music. We'll also hear Scandinavian eating and drinking, plus Juliet Foster. We'll go through the weekend papers. All that to come this hour, live from London, with me, Carlotta Ribello, on Monocle 24. World leaders have been paying tribute to former UN Secretary General and Nobel laureate Kofi Annan, who has died at the age of 80 yesterday. Let's take a moment now to look back at his life.
I, Kofi Annan.
A reputed mediator and admired humanitarian, Kofi Annan dedicated his life to peacekeeping around the world. He was born in the city of Kumasi in Ghana on the 8th of April in 1938 and was named under the Akan tradition, in which children are often named after the day of the week they were born in, Kofi meaning Friday. He went on to study in Ghana, the US and Switzerland to pursue higher education, and in 1962 started to work for the World Health Organization, an agency of the United Nations. Little did he know then that 35 years later, he would be the first black African to become UN Secretary General and the first to rise from within the ranks of the United Nations staff.
As Secretary General of the United Nations.
As Secretary General of the United Nations.
Congratulations, sir.
Annan was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2001, together with the UN, for their humanitarian work.
Peace must be sought above all because it is the condition for every member of the human family to live a life of dignity and security.
He led the organization for two consecutive terms, from 1997 to 2006, a time that was marked by conflict and turmoil around the world that forced the United Nations to change how it operates.
Leadership is not about the individual. When you have mature leaders who believe they have to shine and it all has to be about them, forgetting that what is interest, what is required, is the welfare of society and the people they serve.
This was in the end the era of 9/11, of the US invasion of Iraq, the HIV pandemic, and spiraling conflicts in Darfur, Bosnia, Somalia, Rwanda, Srebrenica, and more. Credited with changing the bureaucratic way the United Nations operated to go towards the model we know today, pushing for peacekeeping missions to be established in regions that were otherwise inaccessible. It was under his leadership that global leaders adopted the Millennium Development Goals and that the doctrine of the responsibility to protect became a reality.
They have to understand that the UN affects our lives in many ways. In fact, including our everyday life. And today we live in a world which is so interconnected. We need to work together to tackle the problems confronting us. And the UN is a place where we meet to discuss these common problems.
Described as a born mediator, he had a personal role in bringing an end to the conflict in Kenya in 2007, the year after leaving the UN, by pushing rivals to come together in a joint government.
To those people in Kenya, I would say this: compromise was necessary for the survival of this country.
9 years before that, he was touching down in Baghdad to meet and negotiate with Saddam Hussein over the weapons inspections by the UN, a meeting that gained him both praise and criticism.
As a result of those discussions, he feels he's on the verge of a breakthrough.
He was also opposed to the invasion of Iraq, calling it illegal.
Secretary General Kofi Annan had some stinging words for the United States.
It's not in conformity with the UN Charter. From our point of view and from the Charter point of view, it was illegal.
His work towards a better and peaceful world didn't end with his last term as UN Secretary General. After leaving, he set up the Kofi Annan Foundation, promoting better governance around the world. In 2012, he was appointed as a joint special envoy for Syria in an attempt to bring an end to the conflict. He resigned 6 months after taking the post, citing interference by the Assad government as well as inaction by the Security Council towards a peaceful resolution to the conflict.
I have therefore informed the Secretary General of the UN and the Secretary General of the Arab League today that I do not intend to continue my mission when my mandate expires at the end of August.
Immediately after his death, tributes poured from all over the world. In his home nation, President Nana Akufo-Addo ordered for flags to be flown at half-mast, saying, "Rest in peace, Kofi, you have earned it." The current UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, paid tribute by saying, "In many ways, Kofi Annan was the United Nations. He rose through the ranks to lead the organization into the new millennium with matchless dignity and determination." And that's perhaps the best description. Just like the United Nations, Annan lived for a better world, navigating through complex issues, deadly conflicts, with some failures and mistakes along the way, but ultimately to help create a world where every generation in every nation has a chance to live in peace. Kofi Annan died in Switzerland, surrounded by his family at the age of 80.
I depart convinced that today's United Nations does more than ever before. It does it better than ever before. Yet, our work is far from complete. Indeed, it will never be.
It's been a decade since the death of one of London's greatest ever playwrights, Harold Pinter. Framed for his one play act, Pinter wrote 20 of them, some of which you'd struggle to see until now. The Harold Pinter Theatre is celebrating the anniversary of his life by showing all of them together, something that's never been done before. Jamie Lloyd is the director of Pinter at the Pinter and joins me in the studio with more. Welcome, Jamie, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
I guess let's start by having a look at the season. We're talking about 20 plays over 24 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite ambitious.
Yeah, yes, it is. It's an unprecedented season of work, really. No one's even attempted this before. These short plays have never been seen in a season together. And it's, why anyone agreed to do this when I had the idea, I have no idea, because it's, you know, an extraordinary amount of work. But it's absolutely worth it to celebrate Harold Pinter and his, you know, remarkable legacy, his, you know, reminding everyone 10 years after his death of his extraordinary impact on international theatre.
Was that why you decided to do this, exactly to remember him 10 years after his death?
Yeah, exactly. I was very, very lucky to get to know him in the last 2 years of his life. I directed his, perhaps arguably one of his most famous plays, The Caretaker, and got to know him. He came to see it, and then it transferred to London from the Sheffield Crucible. And then we then worked together on a production of two of his shorter plays, The Lover and The Collection, in a double bill at the Comedy Theatre, which of course is now the Harold Pinter Theatre, which is where we're doing this season of work. And he was in rehearsals, and we got to know each other over, you know, various lunches and discussions about casting and the productions. And so I felt very, it was a kind of a sort of a personal endeavour, really, in terms of marking this significant moment, this significant anniversary.
Now, what makes Pinter so special for someone that might not know about his work?
I mean, Harold revolutionised theatre. He changed the face of theatre as we know it. I think what he did was to capture the spirit of everyday conversation and often working class conversation. But more than that, he kind of created a very particular poetry with his work, is that he took away anything superfluous. He took away the narrative of plays and concentrated on the distillation of particular thought, and really analysed what was going on beneath the surface. That was the big thing. That's the big thing that Harold teaches us with both his plays and as a political agitator as he became, which is to question everything, to never stop, as he says in one of the plays, never stop questioning received ideas. So there's always something lurking beneath the surface. No one line, no one phrase is reliable. There's always something else going on. So, you know, people, characters don't just say exactly what they feel or exactly what they think. They conceal it. They cover it up with some kind of topspin or carapace. It's interesting because a friend of mine, the actor Douglas Hodge, who has performed in a lot of Harold Pinter's plays, describes it as that there's a kind of a need to explore a kind of volcanic emotion, you know, that there's a kind of an extraordinary angst, an anger, a pain, an invisible line back to the past or some event that has created some terrible loss. Whatever it might be, this extraordinary emotion that's beneath the surface, and then you have to kind of conceal it all and walk on stage and say something as simple as, sit down. You have to hide everything.
What is the biggest challenge? Of course, here we're talking about one-act plays. How is it different between the other forms of plays?
Well, it's actually an exciting notion, because he wrote these short plays across his entire career. So what you're seeing is the extraordinary breadth and depth of his work right from the beginning of his career, with his very, very first play. It's a rare opportunity to see The Room, which is his, you know, where it all began, and then right up to his last play, which is Celebration, which he wrote in 2000. So you're seeing everything that he explored across his entire oeuvre, and you're kind of embracing multiple different styles. You see how things evolve across his work. In the middle, there's this kind of great collection of very atmospheric, very lyrical plays. They're memory plays about our longing for the past, of this kind of golden time when everything seemed content and secure. They're very dreamlike plays. But we start off the season, for instance, with something very immediate, very dangerous, very visceral, politically charged plays, explicitly political, that are very brutal and you know, pretty scary.
Now, what are the challenges then, the way you're describing it, as the plays are so varied, of directing and coordinating all these different plays?
Yeah.
And over such a short period of time as well.
Exactly. It is a challenge, but it's just embracing that. I mean, Harold gives it to you, really. So you just follow his lead. So there are very few playwrights I could say this of, but you just literally follow his rhythm, follow his punctuation, follow the words exactly, and he gives it to you. So he gives you the changes of tone. The joy of it is that all of these plays, whether they're dreamlike, whether they're you know, politically potent and provocative, they're all very, very funny. He considered his plays to be, you know, comedies as much as anything else. And he said one thing he knew for sure about his work is that he got a lot of laughs out of them. So actually there are those little, the joy comes from linking them up, from kind of seeing the motif, seeing the themes that emerge between them, the images that cross from one play to the next, and enjoying the wit of them.
Now, I know that, of course, you're doing season passes if anyone wants to go and see the entire play, but also you have a discounted ticket for £15 if you are under 30 and looking for a job. Is that part of this idea of making theatre more accessible to people? Is that on purpose?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I believe in very, very strongly, and have with my company decided to explore over the last few years in terms of how you make theatre accessible to absolutely everybody. So it's about kind of creating a range of ticket prices. So we have £15 tickets, we have 25,000 £15 tickets, as you say, for under 30s and also for key workers. So for instance, NHS workers or, you know, firefighters or nursery nurses or, you know, and also for those seeking job seekers allowance. And then there's a kind of a top price too. So which of course offsets that £15 price range. So what you really want in the theatre is a generational model, and you want all sorts of people, you want all walks of life, and you want everybody to be able to be inspired and provoked and enjoy these plays.
There's something quite special about a theatre that is full of people that are so different from each other, all enjoying the same play. It's almost time for us to wrap up, but I would like to ask you one last thing. We started this conversation with you talking about how the idea is almost like paying tribute to Harold and his legacy. A lot of the actors casted worked with him as well. Is that what's in mind as well, getting people that want also to perform as a way to pay tribute to him?
Yes, there are some brilliant people like Keith Allen and Penelope Wilton and others who have, you know, performed in many, many different Harold Pinter plays. Leah Williams is directing one of them, and she's been in a lot of Harold's work. So, yeah, there is a kind of personal connection. But also the joy is to bring on people who have never been in a Pinter play, even people like David Suchet and Sir Anthony Scher, Russell Tovey, Martin Freeman, those people who have never performed his work but are major fans of his plays and are very, very excited about exploring them and introducing them to a new generation of people.
Jamie, thank you very much. That was Jamie Lloyd, and Pinter at the Pinter runs from this September until February next year. Now, up next, we hear the romantic misadventures, tragedies, and occasional triumphs of some of classical music's great composers. Do stay with us.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the program delivers definitive insights into the people, places, and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1600 London time. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
Now, what are the stories behind the great composers of all time? But what about the romances and love affairs? How much did they influence the music the likes of Mozart, Puccini or Berlioz would even eventually create? In a new book called Symphony of Seduction, The Great Love Stories of Classical Composers, author Christopher Lawrence delves into the private lives of 10 classical geniuses and the soundtrack that goes with it. He joined me earlier, and I started by asking Christopher about why he chose the composers he did.
The romantic vignettes in their lives lent themselves to the sort of treatment I had in mind, which wasn't so much a documentary approach, but very much along the lines of romantic fiction. And I also wanted to try and look at various aspects, contrasting aspects of their various relationships, whether it be a first-time love affair or a last one or an only one or one of a string of similar episodes. I wanted to give the book some sort of structure that way. But invariably, there are lots of people who have been left out, who had equally vivid lives. Let's face it, we all have a story to tell in that department. Also, the music that was attached to these various episodes was music that I personally was very, very fond of and have been so for much of my life.
Hector Berlioz, you gave him two chapters. He's the only that has two chapters. Why is that?
He's a composer who, more than just about anyone I can think of, had a life and a creative life that seemed to be motivated by his emotional states, and in particular whether or not he was in love. Of course, when we say he's a romantic composer, these days he really is. He was a spearhead of the French romantic movement in music. But the first signature work of his, which is called the Symphonie Fantastique, it's a work he wrote at the age of 26 and is still very much a staple in concert halls around the world. It has a story behind it. Berlioz fell in love at the age of 23 with an Irish actress who was visiting Paris in the year 1827 with an English company of Shakespearean actors. She appeared both as Ophelia and as Juliet on successive nights in the Shakespeare plays. And Berlioz, notwithstanding the fact that he couldn't really speak a word of English, went along with some of the rest of his neophyte romantic tribe to performances at the Odeon in Paris, and was struck firstly by the thunderbolt, the dramatic thunderbolt of Shakespeare himself, who was a huge influence on the Romantics, but also on the person of this actress, an Irish woman called Harriet Smithson. He conceived a passion for her, which went on for years and remained unrequited. In fact, he was such a persistent stage door Johnny that she cautioned her manager and her ring of associates to stay away from the gentleman with the strange eyes. And in the end, when he found out that she was, well, he believed that she was having an affair with her manager, he fell into such a state that within a mere 6 weeks, he vomited out this huge symphony, the Symphonie Fantastique. It's a story about an artist who, when he finds out that his love is hopeless, takes an overdose of opium, tries to kill himself, and instead of doing so, experiences a set of visions in which she appears as a what he called a fixed idea, an idée fixe. So that was his first big work, inspired by an unsuccessful love affair, and he went on to, in fact, meet the woman, marry her, and when that marriage went sour, run off with someone else, and so on and so forth. At the end of his life, when writing his memoirs, one of the great autobiographies, period, of the 19th century, he came up with a phrase that love cannot express the idea of music, while music may give an idea of love.
Now, it'd be interesting to hear a couple more of the examples of some of the chapters you have in the book, like Puccini famously for Tosca or Madama Butterfly. How does that story take shape?
That's an interesting one because Puccini's actually quite rare as far as composers are concerned, and then he was commercially successful. He made an awful lot of money and was in the privileged position of being able to tour his works around the world. So, and it would give him time away from a ménage, which was initially quite happy. He ran off with the wife of an associate of his after having given her some piano lessons. She was a woman slightly older than he was. And they lived in a de facto relationship, quite controversial for the time. This is the last couple of decades of the 19th century, until her husband finally died and she was free to marry. By the time they were able to get married, of course, Puccini had tired of the relationship and was keen to explore options elsewhere. And as a wealthy and powerful and indeed a pretty attractive man in his 40s, the world was his oyster. His eventual wife knew about some of his indiscretions. She sort of had a rule that as long as he conducted them away from home, that was sort of tolerable. She would go along with it. But then she had cause to believe that Puccini was having an affair with one of the maids in the house. And that's when she thought that's gone a step too far. And she publicly went about humiliating and indeed terminating the employment of this young woman, souring her reputation, which was not the sort of thing to do in the first few years of the 20th century in a fairly backward Italian village. And the poor girl felt so disgraced that she took an overdose of poison and died 3 years later. It was an absolute scandal. Anyway, when an autopsy was performed on this poor woman, it turned out that she was a virgin, that all of the misgivings that Madame Puccini had about her husband were entirely, entirely wrong. So the family of this poor dead woman took Puccini's wife to court for slander. They sued her and they won the case. Madame Puccini was about to be sent off to prison. In the end, Puccini had to literally buy the family off to get his wife out of the situation. They separated for a while and eventually got back together. But we've heard about the so-called method acting, where you need a motivation in order to assume a character. In Puccini's case, and when you think about it, Madame Butterfly or Tosca or Turandot, these are operas which are named after the lead female characters. He was fascinated by women in opera. Unfortunately, he tends to kill them off at the end. He kills off almost every lead role, female lead role in his operas, except Turandot, when the slave girl dies, interestingly. But it seems that Puccini, in order to inhabit the minds of his heroines, he needed to somehow form a relationship with a woman somewhere who he felt resembled that character, so that he could literally paint in the character from real life. He's actually trying to write an opera which is probably one of the least known of his works. He's got a pretty good run of successes, but La Fanciulla del West, The Girl of the Golden West. He was trying to come up with a character not like the other women for whom he'd written, who are often quite submissive and docile characters. He wanted a feisty, a strong and an impetuous woman. And it would have seemed that he did in fact find one in the village in which he lived. She was a proprietress of the local tavern years after his death. In fact, it was a bit of a scandal in Italy quite recently. It transpires that he possibly had not only an affair with this woman, but also had a child by her. And there's been a lot of scuttlebutt around Italy about the illegitimate offspring of Puccini wanting to get a slice of the Puccini estate, which is still very lucrative. Much of the music in the book comes from these relationships. If anything, trying to colour in that side of their lives can, I hope, only tantalise or at least deepen our appreciation of the music that sprung out of these situations. And the other thing is a fascination with love is not uncommon. Romantic fiction is the biggest selling genre around the world. And most operas, when you think about it, are to do with love affairs, usually love gone wrong. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm sort of following in a noble tradition, investigating their lives, but also reflecting their own interests.
Christopher Lawrence there, and Symphony of Seduction, The Great Love Stories of Classical Composers, is out now. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Now it's time for a regular Sunday Brunch feature called Weekend Reads. Each week we speak to a different author about their latest work. This week we meet DJ Barbecue. Also known as Christian Stevenson, he found fame through Jamie Oliver's YouTube channel FoodTube. He's since inspired a nation of meat and tube and lovers to get grilling. He began by telling Emma Nelson about his work.
I call it catertainment because I think a lot of chefs take themselves too seriously, and I take my food very seriously, but I also want to have a good time. And cooking barbecue and cooking out, it's all about social gatherings and having a good time. So I wear spandex just to kind of buck the trend. Here's the thing. I cook barbecue whilst I spin tunes. I cook beats and meats. And I always think DJs look really boring, so I wear custom-made outfits by Rita Ora and Jessie J's designer. I know Madonna told me to quit name-dropping. And I wear that outfit just to give someone something funny to look at. If they laugh at me or with me, I'll take any way I can get it.
I must ask, with health and safety in mind, how does spandex interact with fire?
Well, these are very well-made outfits, and they aren't flame-retardant, but they do not hold heat very well. But the problem was I was buying all this women's stuff, and it was just killing me. It just hurt. So I had to get stuff custom made.
What women's stuff were you buying?
Spandex, because okay. They didn't really make full outfits for dudes back in the day.
Why don't we talk about some food?
If it wasn't for fire, we would not have evolved. Back in the old days, before the discovery of fire, we were masticating and chewing for 5 hours a day to get the nutrients. And then we had fire down to 45 minutes to an hour. So the fact that we have microphones in front of us, that you have a laptop in front of you, that you have that book, that's all down to barbecue.
Absolutely.
Yeah, barbecue evolved mankind.
How did you first get into this? Because your book is this rowdy, raucous, very boisterous celebration of cooking meat, the interaction of meat, flavor, and fire.
Well, I think fire and using live fire is like a lost ingredient. One, it's your fuel source, but it's an ingredient. You know, we've been cooking on gas and electricity for, what, you know, over 100 years. But before that, everything was barbecue. Everything was live fire. I just want to go back to where we came from. And when wood combusts and the gases and the moistures and when they come off, you get these sweet wood note flavors that can impart incredible flavors onto your food.
It's terribly scientific.
My charcoal maker is one of the smartest men on the planet. So he went to Oxford, studied theology, had a fall from grace, went and lived in the woods and thatched for 20 years. And then he fell out with his business partner in thatching. And then he went and lived in the woods again and whittled spoons for 2 years. And then he learned how to make charcoal. So he has studied the burning of wood and the moisture ratings and how it combusts. And he can just hold a piece of charcoal and tell you the tree just by looking at it as charcoal. Longest shelf life in the world, charcoal.
And what is the effect when you combine things like charcoal or the right kind of wood and a marinade on a piece of meat? What kind of alchemy happens there?
Well, you create an oxidation happens with the wood. So say I've got a 5 kilo pork shoulder. So I'll go neck end. This is what you guys call it over here. We call it pork butt. There's the picnic and the pork butt.
For those of us who aren't in the room at the moment, DJ Barbecue is showing us his own shoulder as to where we should actually marinate and barbecue. Do carry on. Sorry, I interrupted you.
It's okay. Our classic pulled pork, we take away the rind because we want the rub to penetrate. And I take away a lot of the fat. There's enough fat and collagen and connective tissue in that shoulder. That's why you can't roast shoulder. You got to slow cook it to break down the connective tissue. So what you do is you put that with like a 12-spice rub. Ours is called the Mix of Rad. You put it in the smoker. It goes mahogany. When the wood smoke hits the outer part of that shoulder with the rub, you create this kind of bark, this crust. And that's why it goes pink on the outside and not pink in the middle. Like a lot of amateur grill masters or people that want to learn how to smoke, they go, why is my meat pink on the outside? Like brisket. You know, the smoke ring, that's the oxidation. And that's from wood smoke.
How did you first fall in love with all this?
My father kidnapped me from my mother, who kidnapped me from him when I was 8 or 6. I forgot the year. I was quite young. So my mom was a disco queen of the East Coast. So she was Studio 54, doing demos, dressing up as Wonder Woman, and going to all the discos. Dad was a officer and a gentleman. And he became a greeting card salesman at Hallmark. And then my mom and him fell out. She kidnapped me, took me over the state border, put me at Woodstock Elementary, and I'm dealing with like two parents like fighting over me. And then my dad won me in a landmark court case in the late 70s. And he goes, listen, your mom used to do all the food. I mean, I did some barbecue, and that's all I know. So he taught me barbecue from the age of 6. That was it, man. I was hooked.
And that is now the only way that you pretty much cook. Is that winter, summer, wherever you are?
The kids get so, they're like, Dad, I don't want more barbecue. They get mad at me, you know, because it's always firing up the grill. I prefer to cook out during the winter because I always think it's really weird. Why do you want to stand around hot coals in the summer? Because it's really hot out. I'd rather stand around hot coals in the winter, you know, and that's one of the things I want to try to see if we can change in this country is get people to think about cooking out during the colder months.
There is that thing. We all are very, very much into our barbecues in the summer here in the United Kingdom. And I think it's like half of the population now owns a barbecue of some sort. However, there is that division, isn't there, between the people who have outdoor space and the people, many of whom live in the middle of the big cities, who don't have that outdoor space. If you don't have even 2 square feet to put a tiny portable barbecue up, how do you, can you at all, recreate any of those amazing, unmistakable flavours inside? Is it possible?
There are hacks you can do. You can, you know, get some wood chips and like put them in like a colander or a strainer and, you know, heat them up on your gas cooker and then shove the smoking wood chips into your oven. There are little hacks, or you can, you know, use smoking guns and things like that. But if you want the true flavor of proper barbecue, you have to go outdoors and use a charcoal or make your own charcoal. You don't really get it with gas, but you can get a little wood tin and poke some holes in it and put some wood chips in there and put that little tin on your gas grill, and that you'll get some proper real wood flavor there. But I think you need to really combust lump wood and charcoal to get that flavor.
So you combine making beautiful flavours, but also you mentioned the fact that your mum was a big fan of Studio 54 and you have ended up being a DJ. I'd love
to
know.
You can see the outfits, where they come from, right?
I can. I advise everyone to go on the internet, but do it in a private moment. Go and have a look at what DJ Barbecue uses when he's wears when he's doing his cooking. It's not something that I've ever seen before, I can honestly say. But you combine this brilliant thing of music and food. Now, I completely get that because you need something that lifts the spirits in all ways.
Yeah.
You've actually given us a playlist on the inside of this book, which I absolutely adore. We're going to hear one of the tracks from it now, and I want you to talk to me afterwards about what music you choose when you're cooking. Let's have a little listen to Aretha Franklin. The magnificent Aretha Franklin and Rocksteady. Why have you decided to include a playlist?
Because I think the quickest way to someone's heart is through their stomach and their ears. And that's how we operate. We have a food truck that's got speakers that come out in hydraulics. It's like a transformer. It's like the loudest food truck in the country. And we can plug bands into the food truck. I've got decks in there. And I always say, listen, let's play music for the ladies, because if they're happy, then the guys will stick around, you know, because the ladies are sticking around. And then you wait till everybody's really drunk and then you start playing cheeseball 80s hits, you know. But I always say, don't try to educate people. Play for the ladies and keep them happy. Keep them dancing.
There is this ladies versus gentlemen division here, because the conception that many have is that barbecuing is... it suddenly becomes the domain of a man, which is baffling. And actually,
it is baffling.
Your book's quite macho.
Okay, it might be macho, but women make the best grillers and pitmasters. You guys are so much better at multitasking than we are. You guys are way better. And on a grill, you got to be multitasking. So I always tell dudes, quit hogging the grill. Women are better at it than men. I know I've just upset a lot of dudes. Thinking that's like their outdoor kind of safe space. But
why is it a safe space, though? Is it still as primeval as we all imagine it to be?
I think lighting a fire is very primeval. I think it goes into your inner core of who you are. It goes back to the caveman. It's the whole evolution thing. It is primal. Fire is primal. I love lighting fires, and I love cooking over fires, and I love teaching people how to cook over fire. And I mean, you should see our setup at festivals, man. We've got a whole leg of cow, you know, over a live fire. We've got a big firebox, you know, smoking our pork shoulder, flame grilling burgers. It's just, it's awesome. It's hot too.
We're going to play out with another of your tracks that's been selected. Can you please explain why Africa Toto is such an important track in your cooking world?
Because it's the ultimate tune to get people singing along, and it makes you feel good. And I love watching people sing along. Plus, the guy who wrote the book with Chris Taylor, he usually ends up on the condiment table with a shovel playing air guitar and air flute to this song. It just makes everybody laugh.
I hear the drums echoing tonight, and she hears only whispers of some quiet conversation. She's coming in 12:30 flight. The moon
red wings reflect the stars that guide me towards salvation.
That was Emma Nelson with DJ Barbecue. Fire Food is out now. And to hear more from authors, check out Meet the Writers. You can find a full back catalogue online at monocle.com. Time now to look through the weekend papers. I'm joined in the studio by the broadcaster and journalist Juliette Foster. Good morning, Juliette.
Good morning to you, Carlotta. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for coming in this Sunday. Now, I know we're starting with, is it the Sunday Telegraph? Yes.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I chose this story, which is, of course, is the fallout, if you like, from that appalling accident in Genoa when that bridge collapsed. And it says here, politicians face jeers as Genoa bridge victims are laid to rest. Now, 18 people were given state funerals, 18 of the 41 victims, and indeed the 41st victims were actually found whilst these funerals were taking place. But the reason why I chose this story is because it's the way that it pulled together the sense of despair at the loss, but also the big questions that have to be answered and which go beyond the traditional politics, because we saw some of that politics in the immediate aftermath of the disaster, because we saw Matteo Salvini, who is Italy's deputy prime minister, blaming the EU, which seemed a bit crass, really, because he basically said, well, you know, they've put us under all these budget restrictions and that's affected how we spend the money on the infrastructure. Well, the reality is that this is an infrastructure problem, yes, but it has been going on for many, many years. And I mean, I'm not an expert on EU politics, but I would imagine that if you have money which is set aside, the EU wouldn't tell you, well, you can't spend it on that bridge or you can't spend it on that road. Certainly, if you are a member of the club, there are certain budget rules, etc., that you have to stand by. But in terms of how you spend the money, which you have raised from your citizens, from your tax receipts, that has got nothing to do with the EU.
No, that's absolutely right. And it feeds into that narrative that the EU always ends up being the scapegoat when there are domestic problems within a nation.
Absolutely. And that was the thing which was actually quite appalling about this, that this was a real human tragedy. People were killed. I mean, remember, this was a really important bridge. It was essential to the infrastructure of the region. It was an important part of the supply chain links for hauliers and various other users of this. And, you know, for holidaymakers as well, because of its geography, because it linked this part of Italy to the area of the Mediterranean, the southern Mediterranean, I believe, from what they've said. But the whole point about it is that you've now got the questions which are being raised in a very sort of gentle way in this article, and looking as well at the impact of this collapse on the economy of the north, and the question about the bridge maintenance, and not just the well, obviously it's going to have to be rebuilt. How long will it be rebuilt? But you can't just rebuild it. You've got to make sure that you have a good steady maintenance program in place. But what about the other bridges? What about the maintenance of this? So it's a huge, huge question. But it's the way that they've strung this together and laying bare what has been going on. But you never lose sight of the fact that this appalling tragedy happened. People were going about their daily business, and for this to occur is just appalling.
It's just, that was what was so remarkable when the initial footage and breaking news started coming in, how this could happen in a G7 nation in 2018.
Exactly.
Because it just seems like something that shouldn't happen.
Exactly, in a rich country.
In a rich country, because it has to do with maintenance more than anything else.
Yes.
And there were some reports that emerged in the aftermath that actually concern had been raised that the bridge needed to be properly maintained, and the government dismissed it as just scaremongering.
Absolutely, yes, fairy tales. And the irony was that it was the Five Star Movement, which I believe is one of the coalition partners in the current government, which had actually put the kibosh on some of these earlier programs. In fact, there had been a call about the maintenance, and the Five Star Movement has said no, because it's going to cause disruption to local people. So it's a bit rich to turn around and start finger pointing and saying, oh, well, you know, this person's responsible, that person's responsible. First of all, the inquiry hasn't begun, and given that there are so many actors involved in this drama, it is going to be very complicated. And as I said at the start of this, it's not just one group of politicians that is at fault here. This is endemic. It is built into the heart of the system where there is this laziness about infrastructure maintenance. And this is a terrible way to remind politicians that if you ignore the infrastructure, you do so at your peril.
Let's move over now to another story. Now we head over to The Observer, and this is paying tribute to the former UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, who died yesterday.
Yes, that's correct. And of course, you played your own obituary to him. And the reason why I chose this story is because I was very, very privileged. I met Kofi Annan in Finland last year. And before I'd met him, the impression I'd always had of this man was that he was extraordinarily calm and very, very gentle. Now, we know that photographs can often contradict because some people can project an image in a photograph which doesn't actually tally with the reality when you meet or see them in the flesh. And Kofi Annan was one of the few exceptions, because what you saw in the photograph was what you saw in the flesh. He was extremely gentle and very, very calm and very warm, very likeable, you know. And when I met him, he was, well, it was pegged to two things. First of all, it was Finland's centenary, because it used to belong to Russia, but it's now an independent state in its own right. And it was also the 80th birthday of the former Finnish president, Matti Ahtisaari. Now, Mr. Ahtisaari and Kofi Annan knew each other very, very well. They had two things in common. They were both Nobel Prize winners, or three things in common, both Nobel Prize winners. They were peacemakers. But also as well, they belonged to an organisation called the Elders. Now, the Elders was founded by Nelson Mandela. It's a very simple idea. The idea being that you have all of these ex-statesmen and women, former diplomats. They're advanced in years, but they have this incredible thing that you can't buy. It's called knowledge and wisdom. And they didn't have an axe to grind, but they used those skills to be involved in conflict resolution, but trying to steer people towards peace. If you had all these other organisations, etc., who were involved, that somehow or other, if they were losing track, then it's like, okay, let's talk to the Elders, because they've got, that they don't have an axe to grind.
It's almost like the official mediators.
Yeah, and they are an astonishing group of people. If you ever get the chance to meet them, because they're not driven by money or ego, they just want to help, and they're saying, hey, you know, we understand this journey because we've been there ourselves in different ways, come on, use us. And that's what people do. They use them because they have credibility, you know. And so that community of Elders, they will really feel this, because Kofi Annan was one of them. He was an extraordinary man. He had humility. He knew that he had made mistakes, notably when he was in charge of UN peacekeeping at the time of the Rwanda genocide. He conceded that. And it underpinned what he did. He was determined never to let it repeat itself again. Extraordinary man, a huge, huge loss. And let's remember him for what he left behind and hopefully build on those achievements.
And no one that is, you know, as remarkable as Kofi Annan was does a life without mistakes. And the fact that he's able to was able to recognize them and ensure, you know, without him, the responsibility to protect would never become a reality.
Absolutely.
And so many of the doctrines that we now take for granted within the United Nations stemmed from his principles and his ideas. So it is great to see world leaders across the board paying tribute to him.
Mm.
Now let's move over to the Sunday Times, and this is the front page of the Sunday Times.
Yes, this is an extraordinary story, which really brings in, it embraces several themes. I mean, at the front page, you've got Boris Johnson, who was the former foreign secretary in this country. According to which side of the fence you will look, you will fall on, you'll say he was actually all right as foreign secretary, but there are many who would actually beg to differ on that for various reasons, which we don't have the time to go into. But anyway, as we know, Boris Johnson is a journalist, even though he's an MP, and he wrote a column very recently where he was looking at Muslim women, but more specifically, the way they dress, an item of clothing, the burqa. And he basically said that he was against it because he compared the look to that of a bank robber, because the covering of the face, that you could only see the eyes. He said they were either like bank robbers or letterboxes. And it caused a big stir. I would argue he knew it was going to be cause a big stir, because remember, he is a journalist. And in this country, summer is a very difficult time for journalists to ply their trade. It's called the silly season because Parliament is on holiday. The royal family are usually on holiday. You don't have a total shutdown of the country, but some of the key institutions, they're not quite working at full speed, so to speak. Everyone's got to have a break. So therefore, it means that the media tries to find good stories which they can seize on. And something like this, what he wrote, it was all the right, it had all the right ingredients to cause a storm, which it did. Now, the Times, they've taken it one stage further. They've been digging deep. And what they found is that Boris Johnson has an official website which posts his various speeches and whatever, whatever. And there are also websites which come in support of him. And unfortunately, you've had people making remarks on the Facebook links, which are actually quite disgraceful. They are racist, not just on his own site, but also on the Facebook sites run by his supporters. And some of the stuff I will not read out. But there's one here which says that... That there is no place for Muslims in government, police or the army. There's another one which says, one post threat saying it's crazy to trust them, of course, them being the Muslims. They're just waiting for the jihad signal to turn on us. And it's been hashtag Islamophobic and proud. Now, what comes out of this is that when we look at the internet, we look at it in terms of all the flaws. We look at it in terms of people posting things which have the potential to incite violence. The other element which is worked into this story concerns this lady called Nusrat Ghani. Now, she is a Conservative MP and she was stalked on the internet. She was stalked for 2 years. So on the one hand, we're looking at people posting things which have the potential to incite violence, but nobody talks about people being stalked. And she was stalked for 2 years. And she said what was really scary was that, you know, she's an MP. She has to make herself open to the public. She has to talk to constituents. It could have been somebody who was in her home, who she was handing information to or handling a query, whatever, wherever she chose to handle hold her surgeries. And it could have been one of these people. And she said for her, the relief was when the police finally found the person who was harassing her.
So she didn't have to wonder anymore and look over her shoulder.
Exactly. But she said the relief, the thing which was the relief, was that they showed her a photograph and it wasn't anybody that she had met. But what was really scary was that whoever it was following her. And so if she, for example, had spoken to you, that person would have contacted you to find out something about the conversation where you'd met them. Did she tell you where she's going next? That sort of thing. And they built up a picture of her life. Which is really terrifying.
That is very terrifying and unbelievable. Juliet, we'll have to leave it there. I know we wanted to talk about one last story, but time is short.
Yeah, that's the bookshop. But you've got to go to, I think it's the Maldives, or if you want to actually to go to this place, it's the most exclusive bookshop in the world.
Exclusive and out of sight for the Sunday brunch as well for now. Juliet Foster, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Listening to Sunday Brunch. And finally, on today's show, on the 3rd of September, fans of Scandi Food and Drink will be in for a treat as the executive chef of Aster, Helena Polacka, welcomes Sweden's Niklas Ekstedt to her restaurant for a special event. Helena will recreate some of Niklas' dishes, celebrating the launch of his book, Happy Food. She spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
The chef series is something that I created with Richard Vines from Bloomberg originally. It's in conversation with Richard. In terms of that, my guest chefs are people that I've worked with, worked for, I've been influenced by, or friends and previous people that I've had is Pierre Kaufman, Tom Kitchen, and the last one in March was Angela Hartnett and Sally Clark. So we make a menu, we make a theme, we talk about food, and then normally I create the menu with them, and then we cook it together. And at the same time, when people starting eating on the evening, Richard is interviewing the chef. I introduce the chef. I tell a story behind it, what's connecting us. And then Richard carries on and takes the stories sort of in a live interview to the guests.
And in this one with Niklas, I'm sure you maybe, you know, being from Finland, maybe you kind of, when you saw the man, it's like, oh, I recognize that. Maybe you grew up with this kind of food or is it different?
No, I grew up very much so because I'm from southwest coast of Finland and I spend most of my summers on the islands in the archipelago, and I'm very closely related to in sense of what he's cooking and how we live off land and how we have to preserve and how we need to live through the seasons. So really, I was really excited when I got Niklas's book, Happy Food, and I started reading it, and then we had a phone call and we talked about the menu and I put my ideas on and we were very happy, both of us, with the menu in there and then. So it was kind of set in stone after one conversation, which which was really nice.
Well, I have the menu here in front of me, and I am very happy with it as well. I haven't tried yet, but, you know, amazing stuff like warm smoked Cornish mackerel filet. I think, what is a sofrito, actually?
Sofrito is a kind of a slightly spicy tomato sauce, that which feels really fresh, with red peppers, bit of chili, garlic, shallots, and you make them tender, and then you mix it with fresh tomato that has been diced perfectly, and some herbs. And I think the fact that we love warm smoking is as a method in Nordic countries, and you know, mackerel is works so well when you warm smoke it a la minute, because of it being such a rich fatty fish. So I thought, you know, that makes a nice combination. I was thinking about herrings, because Niklas is talking about herrings in his book, and I serve herrings at Aste, but I think because we're going into September and autumn, so more of a warm food rather than cold. So the combination there, and then Seps will be in a, you know, hype of the season, hopefully. It's been, unfortunately, very dry the summer, so the wild mushrooms are coming slowly, but eventually they will come and it will be exciting.
And Niklas' book, I mean, is called Happy Food. What is happy food for you?
For me, happy food is a social moment. It's food that makes you content. It's food that you either love cooking yourself or cooking together with people. And obviously food that makes you feel good.
Chocolate sometimes can be
happy
food.
Yes, absolutely. So
in a way, no?
Yes, absolutely.
And Helena, I would like to ask a bit more, you know, about your career, you know, in the food industry. I mean, you're also very much influenced by the French cuisine, right?
Yes.
So would you define that the type of food that you prepare is kind of a mix of a little bit of your Nordic roots with French, or how would you define?
My concept at Aste is Nordic French, and it really took me a long time to be able to establish that what and who I am as a chef and a cook. Because I remember opening a restaurant 10 years ago, and I was asked question that, what is it and what's your identity and who you are, and can't you be Scandinavian and this and that. And I found it very hard at the time to tell, because I was more cooking French cuisine, and my love for French cuisine and the fact that it's the establishment, it's the basics, it's the backbone of great industry and kitchens. So I think when I started planning Aste and opening Aste, and I was giving a carte blanche to really to draw the concept on, and I really thought about my own pattern, my heritage, the fact that I have two girls that are now 8 and 12, and you know, we're very attached still to Finland, especially on southwest coast of it, and they're very rooted there. You know, they're both born here, but they always say that they're Finnish and they enjoy their time there. You know, it really came to me through my heritage and thinking of the growing process of myself as a chef, becoming a mother, and thinking of those roots.
And it's funny, especially, I wouldn't even say Scandinavia, but mainly Finland. Is it just me, or, you know, I've been reading recently, there was even a magazine called Fair, which did a special edition on the food more in Finland, in Helsinki as well. Would you say it's a good moment for Finnish cuisine and for Finnish chefs as well, like yourself?
I think we are a very slow-burning nation. We've gone through in history, we've gone through a lot, being part of Sweden 300 years, being part of Russia for 100 years. But we've always been left alone, you know, under those parts of our history. And I suppose, yes, you could say so, but I think it's hard to define Finnish people, I think, and our culture. But I think we often very modest what and where we come from, but we have a very strong backbone, and we're very determined and resilient in that sense. So, you know, maybe it is a moment for Finns, finally.
You're being too modest there, Helena. And also for our listeners who would like perhaps to attend the event on the 3rd of September, you know, what's the best way? Perhaps to go to the Aste website? Or
go to Aste website, absolutely, asterestaurant.com, and you can make a reservation through there. You can contact the reservations team. It's very straightforward. It's on a website. So 3rd of September, Helena and Niklas are cooking at Aste.
Helena Poulaca with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all for this edition of Sunday Brunch here in London. It was produced and studio managed by George McDonough, and our researcher was Julia Webster. Coming up, we have Sons of the East on the Midori House Sessions, and then from midday, Augustin Macellari and Tom Edwards bring us the Monocle Weekly. But from me, Carlotta Ribello, it's goodbye.